Welcome to Sartastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. This podcast is dedicated to Fraser Mendonca, who left Denver and Leti in September 2023 before their October road trip to Northern BC and the Yukon.
Threatening as the northern winter was, with its stern order to the birds to depart, and to the beasts to put on their thick furs, and to the little folk of the snow to hide themselves in white coats, and to all living things to watch well the ways that they took. It could bring no terror to Waisis and her powerful young cubs. The gladness of life was upon them, with none of its pains or anxieties or fears as we know them. And they rolled and tumbled about in the first deep snow with the abandon of the young foxes, filled with wonder at the strange blanket that covered the rough places of earth so softly and made their light footsteps more noiseless than before. For to be noiseless and inconspicuous and so in harmony with his surroundings is the first desire of every creature of the vast solitudes. Meeting the wolves now, as they roamed wild and free over the great range, one would hardly have recognized the little brown creatures that he saw playing about the den where the trail began. The cubs were already noble-looking brutes, larger than the largest husky dog. And the parents were taller, with longer legs and more massive heads and powerful jaws than any great timber wolf. A tremendous vitality thrilled in them from nose to paw tips. Their great bodies, as they lay quiet in the snow, with heads raised and hind legs bent under them, were like powerful engines, tranquil under enormous pressure. And when they rose, the movement was like the quick snap of a steel spring. Indeed, half the ordinary movements of Waisis are so quick that the eye cannot follow them. One instant, a wolf would be lying flat on his side, his long legs outstretched on the moss, his eyes closed in the sleepy sunshine, his body limp as a hound's after a fox chase. And the next instant, like the click and blink of a camera shutter, he would be standing alert on all 4 feet, questioning the passing breeze or looking intently into your eyes. And you could not imagine, much less follow, the recoil of 20 big electric muscles that at some subtle warning had snapped him automatically from one position to the other. They were all snow white, with long thick hair and a heavy mane that added enormously to their imposing appearance. And they carried their bushy tails almost straight out as they trotted along, with a slight crook near the body. After the first deep snows, the family separated, led by their growing hunger and by the difficulty of finding enough game in one cover to supply all their needs. The mother and the smallest cub remained together. The two larger cubs ranged on the other side of the mountain, beating the bush and hunting into each other's mouth as they had been trained to do. While the big he-wolf hunted successfully by himself as he had done for years. Scattered as they were, they still kept track of each other faithfully and in a casual way looked after one another's needs. Wherever he was, a wolf seemed to know by instinct where his fellows were hunting many miles away. When in doubt, he had only to mount the highest hill and give the rallying cry, which carried an enormous distance in the still cold air, to bring the pack swiftly and silently about him. At times, when the cubs were hungry after a 2-day fast, they would hear, faint and far away, the food cry, "Yap, yap, you! Yap, yap, you!" quivering under the stars in the tense early morning air, and would dart away to find game freshly killed by one of the old wolves awaiting them. Again at nightfall, a cub's hunting cry, "Oh, oh," a deep, almost musical hoot with 2 short barks at the end, would come singing down from the uplands. And the wolves, leaving instantly the game they were following, would hasten up to find the two cubs herding a caribou in a cleft of the rocks. A young caribou that had lost his mother at the hands of the hunters and that did not know how to take care of himself. And one of the cubs would hold him there, sitting on his tail in front of the caribou to prevent his escape, while the other cub called the wolves away from their own hunting to come and join the feast. Whether this is a conscious attempt to spare the game or to alarm it as little as need be, it is impossible to say. Certainly the wolf knows, better apparently than men, that persistent hunting destroys its own object, and that caribou especially, when much alarmed by dogs or wolves or men, will take the alarm quickly, and the scattered herds, moved by a common impulse of danger, will trail far away to other ranges. That is why the wolf, unlike the less intelligent dog, hunts always in a silent, stealthy, unobtrusive way, and why he stops hunting and goes away the instant his own hunger is satisfied, or another wolf kills enough for all. And that is also the probable reason why he lets the deer alone, as long as he can find any other game. This same intelligent provision was shown in another curious way. When a wolf, in his wide ranging, found a good hunting ground where small game was plentiful, he would snap up a rabbit silently in the twilight and then go far away, perhaps to join the other cubs in a gamble or to follow them to the cliffs over a fishing village and set all the dogs to howling. By day he would lie close in some thick cover miles away from his hunting ground. At twilight, he would steal back and hunt quietly, just long enough to get his game and then trot away again, leaving the cover as unharried as if there were not a wolf in the whole neighborhood. Such a good hunting ground cannot long remain hidden from other prowlers in the wilderness, and Vases, who was keeping his discovery to himself, would soon cross the trail of a certain old fox, returning day after day to the same good covers. No two foxes, nor mice, nor men, nor any other two animals for that matter, ever leave the same scent. Any old hound, which will hold steadily to one fox, though a dozen others cross or cover his trail, will show you that plainly in a day's hunting, and the wolf would soon know surely that the same fox was poaching every night on his own preserves while he was away. To a casual, wandering hunter, he paid no attention, but this cunning poacher must be laid by the heels, else there would be not a single rabbit left in the cover. So Vases, instead of hunting himself at twilight when the rabbits are stirring, would wait till midday, when the sun is warm and foxes are sleepy, and then come back to find the poacher's trail and follow it to where Elimos was resting for the day in a sunny opening in the scrub. There, Vases would steal upon him from behind and put an end to his poaching. Or else, if the fox used the same nest daily, as is often the case when he is not disturbed, the wolf would circle the scrub warily to find the path by which Elimos usually comes out on his night's hunting. When he found that out, Vases would dart away in the long, rolling gallop that carries a wolf swiftly over the roughest country without fatigue. In an hour or two, he would be back again with another wolf. Then Elimos, dozing away in the winter sunshine, would hear an unusual racket in the scrub behind him. Some heavy animal brushing about heedlessly and sniffing loudly at a cold trail. No wolf, certainly, for a wolf makes no noise. So Elimos would get down from his warm rock and slip away, stopping to look back and listen jauntily to the clumsy brute behind him, till he ran plump into the jaws of the other wolf that was watching alert and silent beside the runway. When the snows were deep and soft, the wolves took to hunting the lynxes, big, savage, long-clawed fighters that swarm in the interior of Newfoundland and play havoc with the small game. For a single lynx, the wolves hunted in pairs, trailing the big prowler stealthily and rushing upon him from behind with a fierce uproar to startle the wits out of his stupid head and send him off headlong, as cats go, before he knew what was after him. Away he would go in mighty jumps, sinking shoulder deep, often indeed up to his tufted ears, at every plunge. After him raced the wolves, running lightly and taking advantage of the holes he had made in the soft snow, till a swift snap in his flank brought Upweekis up with a ferocious snarl to tear in pieces his pursuers. Then began as savage a bit of fighting as the woods ever witnessed. Teeth against talons, wolf cunning against cat ferocity. Crouched in the snow, spitting and snarling, his teeth bared and round eyes blazing and long claws aching to close in a death grip. Upweekis waited impatient as a fury for the rush. He is an ugly fighter, but he must always get close, gripping his enemy with teeth and foreclaws, while the hind claws get in their deadly work, kicking downward in powerful, spasmodic blows and ripping everything before them. A dog would rush in now and be torn to pieces, but not so the wolves. Dancing lightly about the big lynx, they would watch their chance to leap and snap, sometimes avoiding the blow of the swift paw with its terrible claws, and sometimes catching it on their heavy manes. But always a long red mark showed on the lynx's silver fur as the wolf's teeth clicked with the voice of a steel trap and they leaped aside without serious injury. As the big cat grew blind in his fury, they would seize their chance like a flash and leap together. One pair of long jaws would close hard on the spine behind the tufted ears. Another pair would grip a hind leg, while the wolves sprang apart and braced to hold. Then the fight was all over, and the moose birds in pairs came flitting in silently to see if there were not a few unconsidered trifles of the feast for them to dispose of. Occasionally at nightfall, the wolf's hunting cry would ring out of the woods as one of the cubs discovered three or four of the lynxes growling horribly over some game they had pulled down together. For Upweekis, though generally a solitary fellow, often roams with a savage band of freebooters to hunt the larger animals in the bitter winter weather. No young wolf would ever run into one of these bands alone. But when the pack rolled in upon them like a tempest, the lynxes would leap squalling away in a blind rush, and the two big wolves, cutting in from the ends of the charging line, would turn a lynx kit deftly aside for the cubs to hold, then another for themselves, and the hunt was over, all but the feast at the end of it. When a big and cunning lynx took to a tree at the first alarm, the wolves would go aside to leeward, where Upweekis could not see them, but where their nose told them perfectly all that he was doing. Then began the long game of patience, the wolves waiting for the game to come down, and the lynx waiting for the wolves to go away. Upweekis was at a disadvantage, for he could not see when he had won, and he generally came down in an hour or two only to find the wolves hot on his trail before he had taken a dozen jumps, whereupon he took to another tree and the game began again. When the night was exceedingly cold, and one who has not felt it can hardly imagine the bitter killing intensity of a northern midnight in February, the wolves, instead of going away, would wait under the tree in which the lynx had taken refuge, and the silent, appalling death watch began. A lynx, though heavily furred, cannot long remain exposed in the intense cold without moving. Moreover, he must grip the branch on which he sits more or less firmly with his claws to keep from falling, and the tense muscles which flex the long claws to drive them into the wood soon grow weary and numb in the bitter frost. The wolves meanwhile trot about to keep warm, while the stupid cat sits in one spot slowly perishing, and never thinks of running up and down the tree to keep himself alive. The feet grow benumbed at last, powerless to hold on any longer, and the lynx tumbles off into the wolf's jaws. Or else, knowing the danger, he leaps for the nearest wolf and dies fighting. Spite of the killing cold, the problem of keeping warm was to the wolves always a simple one. Moving along through the winter night, always on a swift, silent trot, they picked up what game came in their way and scarcely felt the eager cold that nipped at their ears or the wind, keen as an icicle, that strove to penetrate the shaggy white coats that covered them. When their hunger was satisfied, or when the late day came and found them still hunting, hopefully, they would push their way into the thick scrub from one of the numerous paths and lie down on a nest of leaves, which even in midwinter were dry as if no snow or rain had ever fallen. There, where no wind or gale, however strong, could penetrate, and with the snow filling the low branches overhead and piled over them in a soft, warm blanket, 3 feet thick, they would push their sensitive noses into their own thick fur to keep them warm and sleep comfortably till the early twilight came and called them out again to the hunting. At times, when not near the scrub, they would burrow deep into a great drift of snow and sleep in the warmest kind of a nest, a trick that the husky dogs, which are but wolves of yesterday, still remember. Like all wild animals, they felt the coming of a storm long before the first white flakes began to whirl in the air. And when a great storm threatened, they would lie down to sleep in a cave or a cranny of the rocks and let the drifts pile soft and warm over them. However long the storm, they never stirred abroad. Partly for their own comfort, partly because all game lies hid at such times, and it is practically impossible even for a wolf to find it. When a wolf has fed full, he can go a week without eating and suffer no great discomfort. So Wayeeses would lie close and warm while the snow piled deep around him and the gale raged over the sea and mountains, but passed unfelt and unheeded over his head. Then when the storm was over, he pawed his way out of the drift and came into a new bright world where the game, with appetites sharpened by the long fast, was already stirring briskly in every covert. When March came, the bitterest month of all for the woodfolk, even Wayeeses was often hard-pressed to find a living. Small game grew scarce and wild. The caribou had wandered far away to other ranges, and the cubs would dig for hours after a mouse or stalk a snowbird or wait with endless patience for a red squirrel to stop his chatter and come down to search under the snow for a fir cone that he had hidden there in good autumn days. And once when the hunger within was more nipping than the eager cold without, one of the cubs found a bear sleeping in his winter den among the rocks. With a sharp hunting cry that sang like a bullet over a frozen wastes, he called the whole pack about him. While the rest lay in hiding, the old he-wolf approached warily and scratched Moveen out of his den, and then ran away to entice the big brute into the open ground, where the pack rolled in upon him and killed him in a terrible fight before he had fairly shaken the sleep out of his eyes. Chapter title: The White Wolf's Hunting, by William J. Long, 1905, Northern Trails. You were listening to Aranya Susi Pethonin reading one of her favorite books. This excerpt is from The White Wolf's Hunting, a chapter dedicated to the white wolves of Newfoundland. Why was Aranya Susi Pethonin reading this particular excerpt from this book, Northern Trails? Is because William J. Long is the second founder of the Fraserton School. Now, in the last episode, which was dedicated to DJ Bohm, he is the founder of the Mary Kotka House. There are four houses, as explained in a very long episode where Fraserton turns 106. In that, we spoke about the four houses. The first is the Mary Pelle House, and its guardian, its patronus, is the Atlantic Puffin. And the Atlantic Puffin is the provincial bird of Newfoundland and Labrador. Since the Mary Pelle House is kind of related to the Hufflepuff House, and it's my rendition, so this is the most animal-loving house, and the most, it has all the magi zoologists, it has all the healers, it has all the earthly elements, and Northern Trails is absolutely interesting because obviously it's the wolf. And so this story kind of maps well. And the next episode will introduce the next founder of the next house, which could be the Mary Mies House or the Mary Mezzo House. If you've been listening to the episodes in season 2, you will have noticed that I start with the scenes. The last episode was scene 3, but this is not scene 4. Scene 4 will probably come in the next episode or a couple of episodes down the line. I'm at in the episode with the preface of the same book, and then wrap up this episode immediately because it's just an introduction. This is the Mary Pelle House, and the house has a song. Each house has a song. Lekarin vasta kun verta kustan kavia humori talan musta. In between, you will have heard some segments here and there of a song called Pohjola by Olli Halonen. So that is the theme song of the house, and that's why that song comes up in this particular episode. And everything here is completely fictional with some random facts. It's always going to be fictional through the lens of Aranya Susi Petonen. And from the other episodes, you probably know by now, Susi is wolf and Susi Petonen. Petonen is beast, so the werewolf connection with the Hufflepuff house and Dora Tonks and everything else. I will leave you with the preface, and then we will end the episode after the preface, the regular outro music, and that's it. All right, so I hope you enjoy this particular episode. And if you do like, I mean, if you've never read William J. Long, maybe you can start reading Northern Trails, or the Wood Folk series is pretty good in any case. So I will leave you now and say, as the Finns say, since we are set up in Lappi, Finland, moi moi. The reader who follows these trails will find them leading into a new country, a land of space and silence, away up among the mountains and woods, and Salmon River and mossy barren grounds of Labrador and Newfoundland. There, he will find himself face to face with new animals. White wolf, fisher, salmon, wild goose, polar bear, and a score of others, big and little, that stop their silent hunting to look at the intruder curiously and without fear. In his turn, he will lay aside his gun and his thoughts of killing for a moment, and watch these animals with his heart as well as his eyes wide open, trying to see without prejudice just what things they are doing, and then to understand, if possible, why and how they do them. Why, for instance, the big Arctic wolf spares the bull caribou that attacks him wantonly. Why the wild goose has no fear at home. Why the baby seals are white at birth, how the salmon climb the falls which they cannot jump, and why they hasten back to the sea when they are hurt, how the whale speaks without a voice, and what makes the fisher confuse his trail or leave beside it a tempting bait for you when you are following him. All these and 20 more curious things are waiting to be seen and understood at the end of the trail. The reader who has not followed such trails before will ask at once, how many of these things are true? Every smallest incident recorded here is as true as careful and accurate observation can make it. In most of the following chapters, as in all previous volumes, will be found the direct results of my own experience among animals, and in the few cases where, as stated plainly in the text, I have used the experience of other and wiser men. I have taken the facts from first-hand and accurate observers, and have then sifted them carefully so as to retain only those that are in my own mind without a question as to their truth. In the long story of Wayeses, the white wolf, for example, in which, for the greater interest, I have put the separate facts into a more or less connected biography, every incident in this wolf's life, from his grasshopper hunting to the cunning caribou chase, and from the den in the rocks to the meeting of wolf and children on the storm-swept barrens, is minutely true to fact, and is based squarely upon my own observation and that of my Indians. In one case only, the story of Kopseep, the salmon, have I ventured to make an exception to this rule of absolute accuracy. For years I have followed and watched the salmon from the sea to the head springs of his own river and back again to the sea, and all that part of his story is entirely true to fact. But beyond the breakers and beneath the tide, no man has ever followed or seen them. I was obliged, therefore, either to omit that part of his life, or to picture it as best as I could from imagination and the records of the salmon hatcheries and deep-sea trawlers. I chose, for the story's sake, the latter course, and this part of the record has little value beyond a purely literary one. It is a guess at probable truth, and not, like the rest of the book, a record of careful observation. If the reader finds himself often wondering at the courage or gentleness or intelligence of these free folk of the wilderness, that need not trouble or puzzle him for an instant. He is not giving human traits to the beasts, but is simply finding, as all do find who watch animals closely, many things which awaken a sympathetic response in his own heart, and which he understands more or less clearly in precisely the same way that he understands himself and his children. It is not choice but necessity which leads us to this way of looking at animals and of trying to understand them. If we had developed animal psychology based upon the assumption that life in one creature is essentially different from life in another, and that the intelligence in the wolf's head, for instance, is of a radically different kind from the same intelligence in the head of some other animal with two legs instead of four, then we might use our knowledge to understand what we see upon these trails. But there is no such psychology, and the assumption itself is a groundless one. Nature is of one piece and consistent throughout. The drop is like the ocean, though it bears no ships on its bosom. The tear on a child's cheek breaks the light into glorious color, as does the rainbow on the spray of Niagara. And the law that holds the mountains fast sleeps in the heart of every grain of sand on the seashore. When we wish to measure the interstellar spaces, we seek no new celestial unit, but apply confidently our own yardstick. And the chemistry that analyzes a baby's food serves equally well for the satellites of Jupiter. This is but an analogy, to be sure, but it serves to guide us in the realm of conscious life, which also seems of one piece and under one law. Inspired writers of every age have sought to comprehend even gods and angels by the same human intelligence that they applied to the ants and the conies, and for the same reason that they possessed but one measure of life. Love and hate, fear and courage, joy and grief, pain and pleasure, want and satisfaction. These things, which make so large a part of life, are found in animals as well as in men, differing much in degree, but not at all in kind, from the same feelings in our own hearts, and we must measure them, if we are to understand them at all, by common standard. To call a thing intelligence in one creature and reflex action in another, or to speak of the same thing as love or kindness in one and blind impulse in the other, is to be blinder ourselves than the impulse which is supposed to govern animals. Until, therefore, we have some new chemistry that will ignore atoms and atomic law, and some new psychology that ignores animal intelligence altogether, or regards it as under a radically different law from our own, we must apply what we know of ourselves and our own motives to the smaller and weaker lives that are in some distant way akin to our own. To cover our own blindness and lack of observation, we often make a mystery and hocus-pocus of animal life by using the word instinct to cover it all. As if instinct were the mysterious exclusive possession of the animals and not a common heritage which we share with them in large measure. It is an unmeaning word at best, for no one has told us, except in the vaguest way, what instinct is, or has set the limit where instinct ends and conscious intelligence begins, or has shown how far the primary instincts of a child differ from those of any other animal. On the other hand, one who watches animals closely and sympathetically must judge from what he sees that the motives which govern an animal's action are often very much like our own. The difference being that the animal's motive is more simple and natural than ours, and that among the higher orders, the greater part of an animal's life, like playing, working, seeking food, making dens, outwitting other animals, avoiding traps and enemies, is directed not by a blind instinct, but by a very wide awake intelligence. And this intelligence begins by the use of native powers and is strengthened by their daily occupation, is encouraged and developed by the mother's training and example as she leads her little ones into the world, and is perfected by the animal's own experience, which he remembers in the face of new problems, precisely as we do. A wild animal's life may indeed be far below ours, but he lives much in that pleasant borderland between thought and feeling where we so often find ourselves in our quiet moments. And there is no earthly need to make a mystery of him by talking vaguely of instinct, since so much of his life corresponds to our own and becomes intelligible to us the moment we lay aside our prejudice or hostility and watch him with a patient and friendly interest. I make no claim whatever that animals reason or think or feel as men and women do. I have watched them too long for that. And sitting beside the beaver's village in the still twilight of the wilderness, I find enough to occupy eyes and mind without making comparison with the unquiet cities of men far away. But here, before me, is a life to be understood before it can be described. A life, not an automaton, with its own joys and fears, its own problems, and its own intelligence. And the only conceivable way for me to understand it is to put myself for a moment in its place and lay upon it the measure of the only life of which I have any direct knowledge or understanding, which is my own. And this, far from being visionary or hypersensitive, as the makers of mechanical natural history would have us believe, is the only rational, indeed the only possible way of understanding any animal action. So whether one looks for the facts of animal life or for the motives which govern it, the reader may follow these trails as I first followed them, with the idea of seeing with his own eyes and understanding with his own heart. He will see many things that he does not understand, and so will listen with respect to Noel and old Thoma, who for 50 seasons and more have lived close to the wood folk. And he will find at the end of every trail a real animal, as true to life as I am able to see and describe it after many years of watching in the wilderness. William J. Long, Stamford, Connecticut, January 1905. Northern Trails.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sartastic Beast and Where to Find Them. The intro and outro music is by Yaakov Goldman, courtesy of Free Music Archive.